Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. A little later in our show, we'll learn how researchers at UC Merced are breaking new ground on the global effort to understand climate change. We'll also hear from folk musician Evo Bluestein, who has a new concert and a new book coming out. It's all about the folk music traditions of a special place nestled in the Central Sierra, a venue called Sweets Mill. Plus the latest edition of our podcast all about outdoor life and activities in Central California. We call it Outdoorsy. We begin, though, with concerns about the state's infrastructure that will hit close to home for many local residents. All the rain and snow California's received is filling up reservoirs. That's great for the state's water supply. But in light of the Oroville spillway failure that threatened almost 200,000 lives earlier this year, the safety of other reservoirs now are also in question. FM89's Ezra David Romero reports that some of the same people who warned state leaders about Oroville's risks are now sounding the alarm about an issue at San Luis Reservoir near Los Banos.
For the first time since before the drought began, the San Luis Reservoir west of Los Banos is nearly full at 96%. Thousands of drivers wrap around the man-made lake daily, and some stop here to stretch their legs.
Welcome to Romero Visitor Center, overlooking San Luis Reservoir.
That's where I'm meeting Deirdre Desjardins. From the site, there's a view of the dam, rolling hills, and the valley floor.
You can see it's pretty close to the top there.
She analyzes policy for environmental groups and is concerned that an earthquake would greatly harm the dam, which is holding back about 2 million acre feet of water.
The issue is that there's the Ortegalito Fault runs right through this reservoir.
She says if the Ortegalito Fault or others nearby like the San Andreas Shift, the risk of the dam failing is high. A study from 1999 shows the fault could generate an earthquake of a 7.1 magnitude.
It's a huge public safety issue. You can see down below us, you can see O'Neill Forebay. To the south a little bit is Los Banos. There's 36,000 people. This would just tear through there.
BF Sisk Dam is a 382-foot-tall mound of clay, dirt, and rocks, much like Oroville. The dam is owned by the Bureau of Reclamation and operated and maintained by the Department of Water Resources. It's unique in that water is pumped into it from the California Aqueduct and the Delta Mendota Canal. This water comes from as far as Lake Shasta.
It is a pleasure for me to come out here and help blow up this valley.
That's President John F. Kennedy giving a speech at the site in 1963.
There is no other project in the history of the United States where a state has put in such a large contribution to the development of its own resources.
He gave the signal to detonate the first explosives for the start of the project. Today, the Bureau of Reclamation is working on a project to keep the dam safe when earthquakes happen. Manuel Chowdhury is with Reclamation Safety of Dams Branch. He says if it were to fail, Interstate 5, farms, the California Aqueduct, and 200,000 people all sit in the water's path.
This failure is unlikely for any particular year. However, the consequences of the dam failure could be very severe.
He's figuring out exactly what that probability would be in a corrective action study for the dam that may be released in May. It's all part of a project that started in 2007 to make the dam structurally sound. Chowdhury says there's enough cause to take any seismic activity seriously here. In the early 80s, an 1,100-foot portion of the dam crumbled due to constant wetting and drying of the clay the dam's made of. He says an earthquake could have worse effects.
During seismic event, sections of the dam could slump below the waterline, which results in overtopping. Cracks also may develop. Water flowing through the cracks in the dam could erode the breach as well.
To prevent this, Chowdhury says his team would like to raise the dam by 15 to 20 feet and use a layer of sand to fill cracks if they form. Solutions are scheduled to be proposed in May, followed by an environmental review. He says the project should be complete by 2026 and will cost between $600 and $700 million. Chowdhury says he has a plan if any seepage occurs.
Such as conducting heightened monitoring. We do the daily inspections when the reservoir exceeds elevation about 544 feet. And we have the emergency action plan, which is current.
In the meantime, environmental watchdogs say they have a solution. They'd like the water level drop 50 feet from the top of the dam. Chowdhury says that would reduce risk, but greatly decrease the amount of water stored in the reservoir and isn't needed at the moment because of the other measures that reclamation is taking. He says a water restriction like that could go into effect during a construction state of the project. This isn't the first time watchdogs like this have warned the state and feds about potential dam failures. In the early 2000s, Ron Stork with Friends of the River says he predicted the Oroville failure.
We were stomped like a bug. We didn't get anywhere. Until, of course, nature demonstrated if you run large quantities of water over a hillside, a whole bunch of the hillside will tumble.
And now in light of that failure, he's glad reclamation is taking potential seismic activity at San Luis Reservoir seriously. But he says it'd take a decade to fix the dam is way too long.
They're betting that the earthquake won't happen this year when there's a lot of water in San Luis. Clearly, the Oroville incident dramatically demonstrated that the risks are very real.
And as reclamation continues to study the dam at San Luis, they're working on three other studies to prevent dam failure in places like Folsom. They're also reevaluating 10 other dams for issues, and the California Division of Safety of Dams is looking at least 5 for seismic safety across the state. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Many communities in the Central Valley struggle to provide enough green space and parks. In Hanford, residents have tried to figure out what to do with an 18-acre patch of dirt next to a popular city park. A vote by the Hanford City Council tonight could begin the process of making a final decision about its future. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports the scrap of land is the source of a surprising amount of controversy.
At Hidden Valley Park in Hanford, families, children, dogs, and ducks enjoy a picture-perfect afternoon.
Come on! Come on!
Residents and city leaders say they're proud of the rolling green landscape and large shady trees. However, immediately adjacent to the park is another 18 acres of city-owned land that's long been nothing more than weeds and dirt. Now the city is considering selling that land to developers, rather than expanding the park as some residents had hoped. Ashley Brackens pushes her 20-month-old daughter, Harlem, in a swing.
So the first time that I came here with her, she was still pretty little, so we couldn't really do very much. I was just trying to keep stuff out of her mouth. But I'm hoping now that she's getting older, we'll come more often because she'll enjoy it.
She says she loves the park and would not want the city to sell that land that could someday be used to expand it.
I don't know. It just seems like they should leave it a natural public space. Unless they're going to do something that'll benefit the community more, but I don't see what would benefit more than having a public park for everyone to kind of come and use.
And she's not alone. Some community groups have begun to rally to push back against the city's attempt to rezone and sell the land. Tonight, the Hanford City Council is expected to vote on a proposal to rezone the land to light residential for potential new homes. Currently, no specific developer has come forward, but supporters of the rezone think that land could fetch more than $1.5 million. That would be a big mistake, says Hanford resident Nate Odom.
We've got an opportunity here because of what the space represents, the fact that it was intended as more park space, and that because our grandparents, you know, in the 60s were thinking of the future. They envisioned a 40-acre park because they understood that populations grow.
Odom works with Heart of Hanford, a downtown revitalization nonprofit, and is leading the last-ditch effort to halt the potential sale of the parkland, which has been fought over for decades. He understands that previous efforts only focused on saying no to a sale. But now he says they have a vision for the other land that would transform it from a dirt lot into a self-sustaining urban wilderness, bringing much-needed shade and trees to the scorching Central Valley.
In our general plan in Hanford, it calls for 2 acres of parkland for every 1,000 residents. Fresno is 3 acres per 1,000, Tulare is 4, and Visalia is 5.1. We are really on the low end here.
Odom does not have an estimate on how much it would cost to develop. However, in Fresno, city leaders say it cost about $500,000 to develop an acre. So if those numbers hold, developing this land could cost as much as $9 million. But city council member Justin Mendez says it's time to let this one go.
It's to get rid of some problems. We have to make tough decisions. And I know it's borderline sacred ground to some people, that 18 acres. But to meet the needs of the community, we have to look at all options.
Mendez is one of the main proponents of selling the land. He says for too long, the plot has sat as an expensive eyesore. He says allowing the land to be developed would make Hidden Valley even more popular as families move into homes adjacent to the park. With the money, he says they could add new amenities, like an indoor recreation center near downtown or parks in other parts of town.
The funds from that sale would definitely be a huge shot in the arm for a recreational facility downtown and also meet the additional need of bringing foot traffic downtown. That's kind of a two birds with one stone option.
Mendez points out that the plot has been a drain on city resources just to keep it from being overrun by weeds. And even among people who frequent the park, he's not alone. Sydney Townsend is taking pictures of her niece to celebrate the child's first birthday.
Come on, put your arm, your fingers in the
She says the park is big enough as it is and wouldn't mind selling the land if the money goes towards something useful.
I think they got plenty of space here already because, like, it's never always full all the way, so it would just be more empty space to the park. They got plenty of space here.
And while it's always difficult to predict which way things will go in politics, both the council member and the activists say they think it's likely there's enough votes on the council to sell the land. Later tonight, the 40-year-old question of what to do with it might finally have an answer. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
This is Valley Edition. Recent data from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change estimate that carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere have risen close to 40% since before the Industrial Revolution. The effects of this rise on climate, sea levels, and human societies are still being modeled. However, one long-standing question for scientists has been how plants respond to rising carbon dioxide levels and how their ability to store carbon dioxide feeds back into the carbon cycle. A researcher at UC Merced thinks he's uncovered some answers, and he found them in a place far from home, Antarctica. FM89's Kerry Klein recently spoke with him about his research via Skype.
Elliot Campbell is an environmental engineer at UC Merced, studying the interactions between the carbon cycle, human activity, and plant life. Welcome to the show, Dr. Campbell.
Thanks, Carrie. It's a pleasure to be here.
So your research is pretty varied. In the last 10 years, you've published studies about carbon emissions from all sorts of energy sources, as well as the interactions between carbon and forests and agriculture. Earlier this month, though, a paper of yours was published in Nature, one of the world's preeminent science journals, and the study was also written up in the New York Times. Tell me about this most recent research you're working on and why it's getting so much attention.
Well, one of the big questions right now with climate change is understanding how the plants will interact with climate change. To some extent, we expect plants to be impacted, you know, to suffer from climate change. And to another extent, we expect plants to help try and mitigate climate change, try and slow down the pace of climate change. And that's really what inspired this study, was to try and understand at a global scale how the plants might respond.
And you're doing this research within the context of carbon dioxide emissions, which have been rising steadily for at least the last 150 years or so.
Exactly. Carbon dioxide has been rising because of fossil fuel combustion primarily. But one thing that might surprise some people is that about half of the CO2 that we put in the air every year gets either taken up by the plants on land or by the oceans. So without ecosystems and the oceans working to slow down the pace of CO2 increase, things would actually be a lot hotter already.
Well, so scientists have been trying to answer this question for decades, right, of the relationship between plants and photosynthesis and climate change. How did you actually go about answering it?
Yeah, well, we did something called a natural experiment. We looked at how the world has essentially changed over the last several centuries to try and understand how it might change in the future. And let me just contrast this with how people have kind of gone about this previously. There's a typical experiment that's done where you release a bunch of CO2 in a forest or in a grassland, and you just keep releasing that CO2 so you can kind of get the forest into a situation where it's in an atmosphere that might look like the atmosphere will be, say, 50 or 100 years from now. And you can learn a lot from that type of experiment, but because it's such a costly experiment, you only can do it on a very small area of forest. So the new thing that we did in this study was to really try and find a measurement that works for the entire planet, for all plants on the planet Earth.
And how did you do that?
Well, you know, there's a gas in the atmosphere that plants take up through their leaves in parallel to photosynthesis. So when photosynthesis is going on, they're removing this gas from the atmosphere. And by studying that gas and how it's changed globally, we are able to understand how photosynthesis, how plant growth has changed globally.
So you were neither examining the carbon dioxide directly in the atmosphere, nor were you actually directly examining plants. You were looking instead at this other molecule that kind of serves as a proxy for photosynthesis.
Yeah, a proxy. It's sort of like a shadow that's cast by plants as they grow, but it's in the atmosphere. So a number of scientists from NOAA and UC Irvine have put in a huge effort to make measurements of this this one gas in particular I'm talking about. It's called carbonyl sulfide. Think of it as a cousin of carbon dioxide. It's very similar in its makeup, and that's why plants take it up. Anyhow, these folks from NOAA and Irvine have been making measurements in Antarctica, in a place where no plants grow, right? But when you make measurements in the ice and the snow in Antarctica, by digging down deeper and making another measurement of air trapped in that ice, you get a record of the previous atmospheres, of what the atmosphere looked like 50, 100, or even thousands of years ago. What we did was then go in and try and interpret, try and understand what those measurements were telling us about the plants.
And to be clear, you were not actually in Antarctica making any of these measurements.
No. The work I do is to use computers to interpret measurements that have been made previously. And in this case, those measurements were made in Antarctica by groups of people from UC Irvine and the NOAA National Laboratory.
Okay, so what did you find? What did carbonyl sulfide data in Antarctica tell you about how plants have been faring with rising carbon dioxide rates?
Yeah, well, like I said, the plants take up this gas, carbonyl sulfide, through their leaves. And we found that the only way to explain the historical measurements from that ice and snow, the only way to explain the changes in those measurements is if plants were growing faster and faster every year. In fact, growing about 30% faster than they were two centuries ago, so before the industrial era.
Okay, so what does it mean that plants are growing faster then?
Well, there's all kinds of meanings to this. I mean, first off, photosynthesis, plant growth, is the basis of life on our planet. So it's probably something you want to keep tabs on. It'd be good to know about. A 30% growth is certainly noticeable. It's a lot. So there's all kinds of implications, but one of the implications that really motivated this study is what this might have to do with climate change. One thing that may surprise you is that every year of all the CO2 we put in the atmosphere, some of it is taken out by plants. The plants are sort of cleaning the atmosphere. It's this nice service that they provide. And so by keeping track of how quickly the plants are growing, we can help better understand how much CO2 they're going to take out of the atmosphere.
Right. So it sounds like plants are really acting as a natural buffer against climate change here. Does this mean that this is likely to be a long-term effect, that even as carbon dioxide emissions increase, that plant growth will also increase and offset some of those effects?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. That's the big question right there. We know from the historical period now that the plants are growing faster and faster. They're taking up more CO2. In fact, that same type of process is in our climate change projection. So right now, we kind of assume going into the future that the plants will continue to provide this service. And that's what all our forecasts of climate change are based on. But there is an open question, which is, you know, if the plants run out of nutrients or water or some other limiting factor, maybe they won't be able to do this anymore. The bottom line, though, is that even with this service the plants are providing, we've essentially overwhelmed this safety mechanism. The rate at which we put CO2 in the atmosphere is unfortunately much faster than the plants can take it up.
Now, we've been talking about plants across the globe, but of course, you and I are sitting in this region of California and the world where agriculture is key to our economy. Is there a way to forecast how rising carbon dioxide levels could affect agriculture specifically?
Well, you know, one of the things we know about plants is they grow more vigorously when you put CO2 around them. Sometimes you see this from farmers that have glass greenhouses, and they actually put extra CO2 in the greenhouses to stimulate plant growth. And here we've sort of done this at a global scale, right? Inadvertently, you know, it's through our energy production, primarily burning coal and natural gas and oil. We've put more CO2 in the air everywhere. And this has probably stimulated plant growth and crop growth to some extent. Of course, there's these problems associated with putting CO2 in the air too, like sea level rise and ocean acidification. So at best, it's probably a mixed blessing, but it's really important for us to track this because of its implications for climate change.
So what are the next steps of this research for you?
Well, luckily, not only have these groups measured this gas in the Antarctic ice and snow, but they continue to measure it all around the world, like the famous measurements that are made in Hawaii on top of Mauna Loa. NOAA continues to measure this gas there. So now we can keep tracking the rate of change in global photosynthesis and hopefully get a early warning if indeed the plants do slow down and drop further behind in cleaning up the atmosphere.
Okay, well, great. Well, Dr. Elliot Campbell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Carrie.
And stay with us in the second half of Valley Edition today, the latest edition of our podcast, Outdoorsy. And musician Evo Bluestein joins us to talk about his new book and a concert coming up this weekend at Fresno State. That's all straight ahead on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. Central California has a long history of rich musical traditions of many genres, from country legends like Merle Haggard to rock stars like Journey's Steve Perry to Broadway icons like Audra McDonald. Folk music also has a very rich tradition here as well, thanks in large part to a scene that developed in the 1960s at a place in the Sierra called Sweet's Mill. It's the subject of a new book coming out later this year by Fresno folk musician Evo Bluestein, who joins us now. It's called The Road to Sweet's Mill, Folk Music in the West During the 1960s and 70s. Evo is also leading a concert celebrating the new project this Saturday at Fresno State, part of a new Music of the Americas concert series at the university. Evo, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I want to talk about the concert, but first of all, Sweet's Mill. What was this place and why was it so special?
Well, there was a loose-knit group of folkies in the 60s who started a folk club, kind of the predecessor of our current Fresno Folklore Society. And just enthusiasts in folk music. And they would sometimes, out of their living rooms, just pool their money to bring some guest performers from out of town. There were some folk clubs in Fresno, some little coffee houses. So the book is really not just about this music camp, but where folk music happened and why, sort of. Because, you know, it's not a prominent kind of thing, you know, amidst pop culture. And And so it's about how people who ended up at this place in the hills got turned on to folk music at a time when there was no internet or other resources. Why did they choose it? How did they choose it? It wasn't so easy at that time to find it, to come across it. And this music camp came out of this folk club.
So why did the scene develop, and was there anything particular unique about what was happening here? Was there a style that was associated with this region, so to speak?
Well, we had a few different aspects going on at the same time. There was a place out on the Kings River called Pierce's Park, which is a very colorful place. Some people might remember a very colorful place. It was a bar out in Centerville on the Kings River. But when Otis Pierce, an old codger from Missouri, banjo player, and would unplug the jukebox and hide the balls from the pool table, live music would happen, and people would go out there. And it was just places like that where people would congregate and do folk music until Virgil Bixby, who was the owner of this land up in the mountains, he would stand up sometimes at these folk concerts and say, "Hey, why don't we all go to my place in the mountains? Go home, get our sleeping bags, and go up there and have they would just have these casual weekends up there," which eventually turned into a kind of folk music and dance festival. Little by little, there was a national awareness growing of folk music. And we hear often about the Greenwich Village, New York folk scene first, with Bob Dylan and Dave Van Ronk and other people who came out of there. But we had our own West Coast thing happening. There was another Ozark musician, Ron Huey, was a welder in Fowler, who apparently was a well-known fiddler in Missouri, and so there were some important things going on, and those people played and performed around California. There was the Berkeley Folk Festival and the San Diego Folk Festival, so different things were happening, and Sweets Mill was an obscure place to get to. The culture there developed to be not just American folk music, but international folk music and dance. And it influenced many things that came later. And that's part of the gist of the story.
You mentioned Ron Huey. I want to play a track now. This is track two that we have. This actually features Ron Huey as well as Peter Everwine. You talk about Fresno artists, talented poet.
He was a colleague of my father's in the English department at Fresno State, and a very fine banjo player, as was my father. But Peter Everwine and Ron Huey and a great guitarist, Frank Hicks, were the nucleus of this square dance band, sort of. The Sweets Mill Mountain Boys, as they came to be known. And they did go to the various folk festivals around the state. And so shall we hear that track?
Yeah, let's go ahead and listen to that now. Again, the Sweets Mill Mountain Boys, one of the selections that Evo Bluestein brought with him today, documenting the history of folk music in Central California, a very traditional sound there. Was there also a political element to this as well? As we know, folk music has often been a voice of champions of change and saying, calling things out.
I'm glad you brought that up. Certainly it has. A lot of the people who came to that place were more interested in the traditional music and dance forms that were not so politically oriented. But there's a chapter in this book, which is an interview of Agustin Lira, who was one of the architects of the music and theater scene for the United Farm Workers in the 60s, working with Cesar Chavez. And during the big meetings, which had, you know, Filipinos and Chicano Mexicans and different people, farm workers from all over the place, they wrote little scenes, little theater pieces depicting the struggle. And Agustin was very much part of that and became a composer, performer, and was very influential in the whole movement for the United Farm Workers.
It also sounds like what you're talking about there also applies to, you mentioned the fiddlers, the folks who came out from places in the Midwest, the Ozarks and such, a very much music that's brought to this area by immigrants in some way.
You're reminding me of a wonderful little part of this story, which is, so I was working on interviews with people for this, who were prominent in the early days of this music camp, and a bunch of open reel tapes came my way. So the very same interviewees performing at Sweet Smell in the 60s and 70s, which is amazing to run across. And in there was a recording. I'm sitting there listening to the music from recorded in the mountains in 1960, right near here. And there's this recording of some Chicano singers, folk singers, and legendary mandolinist named Kenny Hall, and they were kind of jamming. And Kenny said, "Oh yeah, I know some Mexican pieces." He went into this tune, and this other Chicano singer said, "Oh, I know that," and he started singing this ballad. There's a CD accompanying the book, which has this wonderful track on it, which is a nice combination.
We'll look forward to that. When is the book coming out?
We don't know exactly. It's kind of in limbo right now. It's all done, basically. Just these projects are a little more complicated than the kinds of CDs I've made all my life, records yeah. I've made all my life. This is quite involved. So it's not quite timed with the concert. However, the College of Arts and Humanities wanted to have a folk music series, a concert series, and started off with this celebration for the book. And so the schedule for that series is up and running with this concert, even though the book we'll have to inform you when the book is actually out.
So the concert's tied to Earth Day. Tell us what's coming up. We just have a little bit of time left.
So I will perform. We have some of the best of the Fresno Folklore Society, Barry Schultz and Terry Barrett, old-time musicians, Don Beadle and Karana Hattersley-Drayton, and Agustin and Patricia Wells Solarsano, the singers I mentioned to you already, and some young people who are students of mine, the Gilly Girls, who just in by way of showing you the tradition lives on, and there's new generations doing this music.
That's great to hear. Again, it's taking place at Fresno State at the Concert Hall? Or?
It's in the old music building
the
Wahlberg Recital Hall.
That's coming up this Saturday. What time?
7 p.m. And I know people think it's crazy to go to Fresno State. It's hard to get into, but it isn't. On the weekends, parking is easy. And if you park just to the west of the amphitheater, you'll be right near the old music building.
Sounds great. And we look forward to that book as well. Evo Bluestein, documenting the rich folk music traditions of Central California. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Our new episode of Outdoorsy is next.
You can feel the boulders hitting the ground within the river through your feet. That's how much water power is coming down.
Hey guys, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This is Outdoorsy, a podcast from Valley Public Radio.
We take you to wild places in Central California and introduce you to people who explore them.
Hey Ezra, I've got a really important question for you. What did one tectonic plate say when it bumped into another?
I have no idea. What did they say?
Sorry, my fault.
Okay, wait, I got a better one. Which cheese was most popular at the geology party?
I don't know. Something aged?
Debris. It won by a landslide.
Oh, man. Okay, well, listeners, get ready. Today's episode is all earth science puns. Just kidding. But it is about the earth and about the natural resources all around us.
Natural resources can include a lot of things, like water, historical artifacts, and animal species. But today we're focusing on things like rocks, gems, and ancient fossils.
We'll tell you how to find neat resources like these in and around the valley, and how you and your kids can learn more about them.
So we've had a really wet winter and spring this year. Reservoirs are brimming, and rivers are full. All that water is moving a lot of rocks down rivers. I wondered what all that water was loosening up and carrying down waterways. So to find out more, I hung out with a few folks who know a lot about the subject. Gold prospectors. We went out to the Fresno River near the mountain town of Oakhurst. Meet Larry Riggs. He's been gold prospecting since he was 6. He's now 69.
That's a piece of gold.
That little speck?
That little speck. I've had 3 pans and I've found 3 or 4 pieces of gold.
Yeah. Riggs is a claim director for the 900-member Central Valley Prospectors Club. They hold monthly meetings, have several claims across the state, and teach kids how to pan for gold at schools. Only about a third of their members are women, but Riggs says many times they have better luck than men do. His wife Kathy is sifting through soil along the river. She admits that often Larry pays attention to where she pans for gold.
I don't know if it's because we like jewelry or what, but there's a good sense of where it is, and we used to have races to see who would find the most gold, and usually I would win, because he goes by science and I go by feel.
Mark White, the group's director, also met up with us. He says all the runoff melting in the Sierra Nevada is creating perfect conditions to find gold.
You can feel the boulders hitting the ground within the river through your feet. That's how much water power is coming down. So anytime you have that hydro movement, you have gold movement. You have things breaking loose.
That's why White, the Riggs, and 2 of their friends are searching through rock and sand in the river for the precious metal. And at $1,200 an ounce, they say every flake they find is worth it. White says all you need to find gold along mountain streams, lakes, and rivers is a shovel and a pan specifically made for gold panning. The pans we use have 3 ridges on one side that trap fine flakes. Riggs and I waded a few feet into the river and dug into the soil under a calm area of water.
Now what you want to do is get the whole pan underwater.
Okay.
And just shake it. And then reach in and grab those roots and shake those in there.
Riggs was excited to bring me out panning for my first time. He told me the goal is to get all the big stuff out and hopefully just get down to sand and flakes.
We'll get you some gold today.
He says you can sift the rocks from the soil using a metal net, but we just pluck the rocks out with our fingers. Riggs looks at each rock in the sun to see if there's a vein of gold in it. He says a rock with gold embedded in it can be worth more than gold itself. When the rocks are gone, Riggs has me slowly swish water around the pan while letting excess dirt and water out of it.
You're a quick learner.
Right?
Yeah, and you're getting it down to black sand now. That's what you want. You can kind of turn and get the whole thing in the sun. It helps you.
Okay.
Let me help you a little bit.
Sure.
Riggs says gold is really heavy, so it's usually the last thing left in the pan.
Is this gold?
That's gold.
Oh.
That one's gold.
Found some gold.
I think I saw 2 pieces of
gold. I did too.
That'll be yours because you have it.
Gold panning is really simple, but could be very addicting. Before we left, the group warned me about an illness they've all had at one time in their lives. They're talking about gold fever, where people may do crazy things for gold because of its worth. Mark White, the group's director, says people have murdered each other over the precious metal, and not just during gold rush times.
It can get real ugly real fast the bigger the gold, and nowadays it's a little bit better. Back in the old days, they just drop you and take it. You don't want to be bragging too much or strutting around too much, but you do want to come out and enjoy yourself.
That's why White says it's important to make sure it's legal to gold pan in the area you intend to go to. He says you can call the Central Valley Prospectors Group to find out more. And as I left, I slipped my tiny vial of gold flakes into my pocket and drove down the hill back to Fresno. But not before the old timer asked me a question.
How did you feel when you first saw it?
I had a little rush.
You betcha.
When you walked away, I was like, I have gold fever.
So Ezra, you've got gold fever.
Yeah, I love it.
Me, I like digging around for shiny objects too, but I go more for just pretty rocks and cool looking crystals.
Tell me more.
Well, I was wondering, if people are still finding gold around here, what else lies beneath the surface? To find out, I wanted to find a rock collector. Surprisingly, my search didn't take me to a mountain community or an active mining town, but a military town in the middle of ag land, Lemoore.
Hi, are you open?
Yes, we are.
So come on in.
This is Pereira's Jewelry and Design. It's a jewelry store that's been in downtown Lemoore for 30 years.
I do feel like sometimes we're becoming the historians downtown only because we've been here so long.
John Pereira runs the store with his wife, Judy. They've got walls full of glittery diamonds, gold, and silver, but they've also got cases full of blue, brown, and green minerals John's collected from around California. Not only is John a jeweler, Ezra, but he's a lapidary, which means he can cut and facet rocks and crystals, and he's a self-diagnosed rock hound.
I like to look for bonitoite. I like to look for jade, like nephrite jade and jadeite. I like to go out in the desert, look for agates and jaspers and some quartz materials, chalcedonies.
You've likely seen those minerals before. They're pretty common in jewelry and art pieces. Jasper, chalcedony, and agate are found in a variety of colors, from reds to blues to vibrant stripes, and they're similar in composition to the common crystal quartz. Jade minerals come in a range of creamy greens and blues that lend themselves nicely to sculpture. Bonitoite's less common. It's a blue gemstone, which happens to be the state gem of California. All of these, John finds out in nature, and he brings them back into his work.
All of the agate and jasper and bonitoite and druzes, all of those things we make. We make probably half of what you see in here, and a good part of the colored stone jewelry.
John started the Lemoore Gem and Mineral Club a few years ago, and for a couple years, he and Judy even helped organize some local gem shows. On the day I visit, he's laid out a table with some samples he's collected from around California. He dips them in water to show me what they'll look like when they're polished. Some of these are hyper-local, like this lovely crystal that almost looks like a big hunk of pink Himalayan salt.
What's this pink
stuff?
This
is rose quartz. And this, I can't remember the name of the actual location, but this is found kind of above and east of Delano, kind of between Delano and Porterville up in the hills up there.
Another rock in John's collection might be a little easier to overlook. On first glance, it just looks like any other brown spotted rock. But after some work from a lapidary like John, the colors pop out into a bright artist's palette. It's called Rainbow Ledge, and it's a combination of jasper and agate found in Ridgecrest, not too far from Bakersfield.
And the patterns vary a little bit. See, you've got some agate running through the jasper.
It's so striking.
It is. It's very pretty when it's polished up. It doesn't look like much when you see it like this, but when you polish it, it has a lot of color.
There's plenty more around California if you're willing to drive a fair ways further. John finds petrified wood and blue and green chalcedony out in the Mojave Desert, and he says you can find all different types of jade in a few coves on the coast near San Simeon. John says one of his favorite stones is pearly lustrous opal. But for me, standing in the middle of his store, I gravitate toward a display full of deep blue crystals near the front window.
This is where we display the bonitoite. I have a little bit of everything there, from finished jewelry to specimen pieces.
Bonitoite looks almost like sapphire, but the blue is a little bit softer. And the specimen pieces, which are basically just bonitoite crystals in their natural rock, are gorgeous. The mineral was first found in southeast San Benito County, not far from the edge of Fresno County. It's rare, and it can actually be worth a lot. John says he finds really nice samples up around Clear Creek in Lassen County, but you can actually find bonitoite at the site where it was originally mined. It's called the Cal State Gem Mine, and it's out near Coalinga. You can sift through tailings for any chunks left behind from the mining process. You pay $70 for the day, and you can take whatever fits in the bag they give you.
We just had a young couple in here about a month ago. They went up there for the day, and the first shovel of dirt they took out of the tailings had a large bonitoite crystal that's probably going to cut a stone, depending on what the faceter thinks of it. They'll get something from $1,500 to maybe as much as $6,000 out of it. It's a really pretty stone.
So rock hounding seems like it is what you make of it. It can be a hobby, but you might be able to make some money out of it. Or fold it into your career, like John has.
Yeah, some people just want to look at the rocks. They put them on a shelf, and that's as far as it ever goes. Some people get into cutting and polishing. Some people like to make spheres out of them. There are just a lot of aspects of it.
If you're thinking of getting started, it's important to always know where you're going and what the laws are about whether or not you can harvest the materials you find there. To get to know the ins and outs of mineral prospecting, John recommends joining a local gem and mineral club. You can attend meetings, join field trips, and even take classes on becoming a lapidary. There are a bunch of clubs in the Valley. Not only Lemoore, but also Fresno, Bakersfield, Coalinga, Visalia, Porterville, and many others. We'll have more information on our website.
Wait, what's going on? This isn't our usual music. What are we listening to, Carrie?
Okay, it's from a video. It'll make sense in a minute. You know how for our final segment, we usually talk about gear or food?
Yeah, like chunky bread. I love it.
No chunky bread today, unfortunately. But today I decided to do something a little different. Time travel.
Wait, what?
Shh, the video's starting.
Today, during your visit, we will be taking you back in time to Fairmead, California, 700,000 years ago. We will travel to a time before humans were here, a time of gigantic beasts, ferocious carnivores, and a variety of animals that are now extinct.
This is the intro video at the Fossil Discovery Center in Chowchilla.
Oh yeah, I think I've seen signs for it on Highway 99.
Yeah, you should stop there sometime. You can just find that video on YouTube if you want, but it's so cool to actually be there in person. Right inside the door, you're face-to-face with a giant skeleton standing two stories tall.
This is the Columbia mammoth, and stood about 14 feet tall and could weigh approximately 10 tons.
My tour guide was Michelle Piscina, manager of the museum, and yeah, there's a replica mammoth skeleton in Chowchilla.
It ate 300 to 600 pounds of grass a day. It had six sets of four molars each for its life. And when it lost its last set of molars, it would pass away because it can no longer eat. So the teeth were very, very important to this animal.
This is the museum's centerpiece, but there's a lot of other stuff here too. And the museum is here almost by mistake.
Wait, what do you mean?
It wouldn't be around at all if it hadn't been for trash.
Trash?
Well, this center got started as a result of the find in May of 1993 of a Columbian mammoth tusk at the Fairmead landfill.
You know, usually when I'm in Madera County, it's all farmland. I didn't think mammoths once lived there.
Yeah, if you think about it, this place wasn't always farmland. That mammoth tusk is around 700,000 years old, from a time period known as the Pleistocene. For reference, that may seem like a really long way back, and it is way before modern humans had evolved, but by that point, human ancestors elsewhere in the world had already begun using tools and learning to control fire, and it's way after the dinosaurs. Back in modern-day Madera, there isn't a lot left over from that time period, so finding that tusk spurred on a local paleontology frenzy. In the 25 years since then, they've uncovered over 13,000 fossils at the landfill across the street.
This effort is called Salvage Paleontological Effort because the priority, of course, is for the populace to have a place to put their garbage. It was incidental that this find occurred, but they still need to be valued as historical artifacts, so there is a plan if they're digging and they come across a fossil to stop to where it can be evaluated.
Through those efforts, paleontologists have gotten a pretty clear picture of what Pleistocene Madera County looked like. Michelle describes it kind of like the Serengeti. It was dry and desert-like, but it did have scattered water sources. And like in modern-day Africa, those oases drew in all sorts of animals. Some came to drink the water, and others were there to eat those animals. And those that died there left behind bones for us to find.
We have mostly the Pleistocene horse. Then we have, of course, the Columbian mammoth and a variety of sloths that have been found, the camelops, the saber-toothed cat, and let me see, the dire wolf and the short-faced bear.
What's a camelops? Is it like some kind of weird-looking camel?
Yeah, pretty much. It's an extinct group of camels, similar to dromedaries. But what really surprised me was the dire wolf. It's a fierce carnivore I've only heard of because of the fantasy author George R.R. Martin.
Dire
I had never heard of a dire wolf before the Game of Thrones series. I can't believe that's an actual species.
Yes, I've also watched the Game of Thrones, and the dire wolf has attained almost a mythical quality, but the dire wolf was definitely a carnivore that roamed our area.
So it's not just mammoths here. They've got display cases full of local minerals and rocks, posters about ancient plants, and replicas of the skeletons of all the major mammals found in the area.
Did they have any saber-toothed tigers? They're like my favorite extinct creature. You know, I liked them since I was a kid.
Yeah, Michelle actually brought me over to a saber-toothed cat skull that you could touch. She told me to check out their huge, saw-like canines.
We'll have you touch the back of this one. It's a replica. To touch the serration. You feel the serration?
Whoa.
Yeah, which that was a fascinating thing to learn. It was just like a knife.
Kind of gives me chills.
It is. They were a fierce creature. And the other thing they could do is fully open their jaws to take in the head or body parts. They were completely opened past almost 90 degrees there.
Michelle says around 10,000 students come through the museum every year, so almost everything's interactive. In fact, according to Michelle, one of the most popular exhibits is a mock dig. Near their artificial pond out back, they have a big sand pit where they've buried a few dozen bones for kids to dig up. She pulls out a brush to show me how it works.
We show them how a paleontologist would approach this, and so we show them how to carefully move the dirt off. We put them in partners usually, and then that they would use a brush. Of course, they would have other tools. And then outside, they have one of these binders, and they're able to identify what they're digging up.
But one of my favorite exhibits wasn't about extinct animals, but about people. One person, actually. It's an homage to Mary Anning, the first known female paleontologist. She's British, and she's got no connection to California that I'm aware of, so I think it's especially cool that the curators chose to highlight her and her contributions to the field of paleontology.
It sounds pretty cool. I totally want to go.
Yeah, I think you should, and anybody should who's got kids, especially if you're looking for a way for them to play and actually learn something. Plus, it's right off the 99 between Madera and Chowchilla. You can stop by on your way to collecting cool rocks in Northern California.
And that's today's show. Check out our website for rock and mineral clubs near you and where to get a gold pan. Share a picture of yourself on the hunt for rocks and gems on Instagram or Twitter. We're at Outdoorsy Pod on both.
Our editor is Joe Moore, and we had engineering help from Don Weaver.
Our music is by Kevin McLeod and Ben Sound.
Stay tuned for future shows when we visit other wild places and interview the people who love them. For Outdoorsy, I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Ezra David Romero. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
That's all for Outdoorsy and all for this edition of Valley Edition. We hope you enjoyed today's program. As always, we'd like to know what you think. Send us an email. We are talk@kvpr.org. Also on Twitter @kvpr and @Valley Edition. You can find our Outdoorsy podcast and more audio archives of all of our feature news reporting and local stories on the website, kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. You've been listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.